Chokwe Lumumba is an attorney based in Jackson, Mississippi. Throughout his more than 30 years as a lawyer, he has dedicated his work and his life to the cause of human rights, the struggles against racism, and defending political prisoners. He played a key role in the student struggles of the 1960s, was vice president of the Republic of New Africa, and has played a key role in some of the most significant political cases and movements affecting African Americans and human rights over the last 25 years. Brother Chokwe was a co-founder of the National Black Human Rights Coalition, the Detroit Black Human Rights Coalition, the New African People's Organization, and the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement. He played a key role in defending political prisoners in the 1970s and 1980s, serving on the legal teams of Fassad Shakur, the Pontiac brothers, Dr. Mutulu Shakur, Bilal Suni Ali, Fulani Suni Ali, and Geronimo Pratt. Throughout his political and legal career, he and his family have been a target of COINTELPRO and court systems that have attempted to disbar him from practicing law and standing for human rights. In 2005, Brother Chokwe founded the Mississippi Disaster Relief Coalition and worked with both the Post-Katrina Tribunal and the Right to Return movement in New Orleans. He was a member of the City Council of Jackson, Mississippi, and became the mayor of Jackson, Mississippi in 2013. He was a member of the National Conference of Black Lawyers, and currently as mayor was working on the Jackson Rising New Economics Conference coming up later this year. Brother Chokwe made his transition on February 25th, 2013, Ashe. We listened to Brother Chokwe talking initially about the New African People's Organization and New African People.
I think African American, of course, is a term which I think I usually start by explaining that Malcolm used the term. He used African American and Afro-American, but he was very clear why he used it. I think that it's being used out of context now in a way which I think is best for us not to use. Malcolm was saying we are Africans born in America. That he used the analogy, he says, is that because a kitten is born in the oven, it doesn't make it a biscuit. Malcolm went on at many occasions to explain is that I'm not a Democrat, I'm not a Republican, and I'm not an American. I'm one of the 22 million victims of America. What he was doing is what we do when we use the term New African. We're saying that our identification is with Africa. And it's, of course, a new African nation here in America, as there are new African nations all through the African continent, as different types of old African nations or tribes come together, they form new African nations. And even if just a old African nation existed, it becomes a new African nation over a period of time. And, of course, we have new African nations in the Western Hemisphere all over the place. So what we're saying, though, with the term African-American, and we kind of borrow from Elijah Muhammad when we say the so-called African-American, is because to label us an American, we think, is, A, incorrect objectively, but secondly, it is also not consistent with our political and economic and social and interests as it relates to American being the body politic, American being the government, American being the socioeconomic structure and the empire. America's an empire. That's what it is. The what we call America, the United States of America, is an empire. And so we are the victims. Malcolm put it real clearly. We are the victims of that empire. We are not part of that empire. Now, we can agree, like by international law, you can agree to become part of any state that you choose. Our attachment to the American state as a people has been involuntary, and we have never made an informed choice to be a permanent part as a people. There's individuals, I'm sure, that have made that kind of choice. But as a people, we would be entitled to the same kind of apparatuses and choice mechanisms as various people around the world when they're given the opportunity to participate in a plebiscite. Do we want to become part of America? Do we want to go back to Africa or to go to some other place? Or do we want to have a nation of our own? Or do we want to do a combination of those three things? And if it is, in any part of our combination is to become part of America, do we want to become part of this America that exists now? Or do we want to create some new entity which could perhaps be called some kind of Federation of American Nations or whatever, you know. So that's the idea.
Chokwe Lumumba is an attorney based in Jackson, Mississippi. His 30 or 40 years of life have been dedicated to the cause of human rights, the struggle against racism, and defending political prisoners. Key role in the New African Movement, founded the Mississippi Disaster Relief Coalition, worked with Katrina and the Right to Return. On February 25th, Brother Chokwe Lumumba made his transition, joining Africa Day to talk about his friend and comrade, Dr. Akinyele Omoja, a founding member of the New African People's Organization and the Malcolm X grassroots movement. He's an author of a book, We Will Shoot Back, Armed Resistance in the Mississippi Freedom Movement. And most importantly for today's conversation, he was a good friend, a comrade, a co-worker, a soldier, along with Chokwe Lumumba. First of all, Akinyele, our blessings to the family, the extended family, the community of Brother Chokwe. How did he translate his wealth of experience and knowledge to the young people when he began to move into traditional politics on city council? How did he do that, Akinyele?
Well, that's something that Chokwe was always into, was like trying to prepare the next generation. So even as an attorney, he was always preparing younger attorneys. One of the things about our organization, Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, is we've always made an attempt to make it an intergenerational movement. So, you know, Chokwe 66, I'm approaching 60. No, but we have people in there in their 40s and 20s. Who are in our organization. So it's always important to try to transfer from one generation to the next. Because, you know, we know, as you know, his death also informs us we're not going to be here forever, but the work is going to continue, right? And so he's always prepared other people, other attorneys, other activists. And that's, you know, ever since I've known Chokwe, I've known him. I worked with him since 1979. I've known him since 73. He's always had younger people around him that he's training and mentoring. That's just who he is.
Talk about the depth of Brother Chokwe in the Black Liberation Movement. This is a term that you use in your book that you're writing. I mean, we won't get everything, but what's the meaning and his significance of Brother Chokwe, Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, the Republic of New Africa, the New African people? What's the significance to us, to our communities, Akinyele?
Well, I'll talk about his life specifically. You know, he's a person who was a young man, a student athlete, really before that even. His mother takes him door to door to raise money for SNCC. And so he, coming out of a Black working class family in Detroit, his parents always taught him character, taught him certain principles, morality, but also taught him to serve his people. And so he kind of took that, I think, what really sparks him coming into the movement in a real intense way was after the assassination of Martin Luther King. He always talked about that. And he sought out groups, and he found the Republic of New Africa. Now, the Republic of New Africa, and I see Chokwe in this light too, tried to continue the tradition of Malcolm X in terms of self-determination. And what does that really mean? You know, the Black people governing themselves. I was actually listening to a speech from Chokwe this morning from 2008, and he talked about how Malcolm, when he talked about Black nationalism, talked about Black people controlling their own communities. And so when we look at what he was attempting to do in Jackson right now, I think he was saying if we had an opportunity to move into these offices on a local level, we need to do that, but we need to do it with an agenda and a plan that's going to help empower our people. So he saw in what people commonly, what people popularly now call the Jackson-Cush plan, Cush is the area that the Republic of New Africa decades ago identified western part of Mississippi that runs along the Mississippi River. There are a series of counties that are majority Black. And so years ago they talked about that's where they would begin to try to organize Black people to build institutions, to create economic cooperatives based upon the Ujamaa principle of cooperative economics that we talk about in Kwanzaa annually. Okay, but they talked about building there. So Chokwe was going to start in Jackson. He got elected, and they used a different model of holding a politician accountable and organizing people through organizing the People's Assembly when he first ran for city council in his ward. And that was going to be the basis of trying to get people to participate, but also just to try to give us some new political forms and new to try to create a new political culture for our people there.
Okay.
Then just electing somebody and then, you know, they rip us off and then we elect them again two years or 4 years
later. Gotcha.
And so he was trying to build on that basis, based upon the tradition of the movement, but that he had learned as a young man, but trying to apply them to our reality today, particularly in Mississippi. And from Jackson, they were going to organize other communities and unite with other communities to build a base of black power there.
You know, some of his work, there's so many things that Brother Chokwe Lumumba was involved in. You know, one of the things that always clicks in my mind is his work around issues of reparations and his work around issues of political prisoners. That's the work that MXGM does. Talk about how Chokwe fit into that, using his legal skills, using his issues of land in terms of building movements.
Well, Chokwe, as you said, has been an advocate of reparations. He argued, he was one of the founders of NCOBRA, and our organization, NAPO, New African People's Organization, is a founder of NCOBRA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America. He constantly believed that, you know, our ancestors, but not only our ancestors during slavery, but our ancestors who were Jim Crow, and even up into the day when our people suffer damages, but nobody compensates us really for the damage that we suffer from miseducation in our schools and things of that nature, that reparations was a key. And as an attorney, he believed that oftentimes the principle, legal principle that we try to seek redress is the 14th Amendment. And the 14th Amendment says that we should have equal and due process in society. But he knew that that was going to be turned against us. He told me that years ago. And he said it was the 13th Amendment, because after the 13th Amendment, which is supposed to have gotten us out of or ended involuntary servitude or slavery, he said, but it didn't provide the means for us to become really free people. And he said it was responsibility of this government to pay us reparations at that point. So, you know, we needed to have reparations claims as the basis of our freedom movement in his country. He truly and honestly believed in reparations, and that's where he was coming from. He also believed, and one of the things the Republican New Africa argued years ago is that we needed to build new communities, and he saw the economic projects that they were building. In fact, there's going to be a conference in Jackson, May 2nd through 4th this year, the Jackson Rising Conference, that talks about cooperative economic development. And so we needed to build new communities based upon cooperative economics, us sharing and pooling our wealth together and investing together and managing our businesses together, not as employees or slaves or servants, but as owners of enterprises in our community, as a transitional force to begin to develop a society, you know, really based on socialism, because Chokwe was very clear that he was a socialist also. And so when we talk about freeing the land, that's what he talked about, and that he knew that land was the basis of independence. And so even now, There are efforts in Jackson to build, and he wanted to even expand urban agriculture, but also reconnecting and reinvigorating relationship with farmers in the rural areas to try to revitalize the economies in black communities there.
Okay, you know, Akinyele, when I've been listening to people talking about Chokwe, I've heard Jill Elijah, Sophia Elijah say uncompromising. I've heard people talk about one of the tapes we talked to, undying love for the people, love for the people. Principles. Talk about principles that made Chokwe who he is that makes him reverent, that makes him important, makes him significant. What comes to mind, Akinyele?
Well, Chokwe always said, he said, if you don't love the people, you ultimately betray them. And that was the principle he used to always tell activists, right? And Chokwe did have this love and commitment for our people. I'll tell one story. When he was running for city council, the day before the election, I was going door to door for him. And his opponent had put out and had a press conference and said, and they were running a Democratic primary, because Chokwe wasn't a Democrat. And I'll tell you more about that later. But so we were going door to door, and I knocked on a gentleman's door. And he came to the door. This guy was, he was an elder. He was in slippers and a robe. And before I could get, you know, my spiel out, he said, "We know Chokwe ain't no damn Democrat." That's not why I'm voting for him. And then he listed, you know, because Chokwe had been living in Jackson since the late 80s. He listed political activities that Chokwe had been involved in since he moved there, you know, fighting Klan mobilizations, working for workers' rights, fighting against police abuse and terrorism, just fighting for nameless and folks who had been abused by, you know, the power structure. And speaking out, he even pointed out that Chokwe was, there was an attempt to disbar him earlier, right, because he had challenged a racist judge down there. And so the guy said, "That's why I'm voting for him, not because he's a Democrat or anything else." And so this guy had identified that Chokwe had been consistent in fighting for his people. And for Chokwe, love didn't mean, "Well, I tell you I love you, but you know, I'm gonna do whatever I want to do." No, Chokwe committed his time, his thinking, because he always thought about liberating our people, his money. He helped organize his family. His children have always been, and his wife, they've always, she's deceased, Nubia Lumumba. They were all a unit that was a part of our liberation movement. They were all part. Chokwe, when he used to introduce himself as the chairman of the New African People's Organization, he would say, "I'm speaking to you on behalf of the men, women, and children of the New African People's Organization," because he saw our families as connected to this movement. When I was doing his campaign for mayor, but even before that, his siblings, his nieces and nephews, he's always organized to be a part of this movement. And so that demonstrates his love, that he put all his resources, all his relationships were a part of this movement to free our people.
You know, he got a wonderful note, and to say a few words here, and to keep just a few more minutes, from Venezuela, Chokwe the Internationalist.
Right. Well, Chokwe believed he was a nationalist. At the same time, he was a person who loved humanity. He genuinely loved people, and he knew that an expression of that love was solidarity with other people. And at the same time, he also demanded reciprocity. And so, for instance, in 2010, he and I led a delegation to Haiti to examine, to see what was going on in Haiti relative to our people after the earthquake. We went, the earthquake was in January, we went in August, and in the spirit of, you know, the Bear resident activist, who's now deceased, Javad Jahi, who also was dedicated to liberation and democracy in Haiti, we went in his spirit to Haiti just to see what was going on. And Chokwe very much embraced people there, and was embraced by people there, and became an advocate in solidarity with not only the fact that the resources of our people, our resources of people around the world that were supposed to be directed to Haiti weren't getting to the Haitian people. So we spoke out on that, but we also spoke out at that time that President Aristide was still being banished from Haiti. And so we echoed the demand of for that human right of Aristide to be returned. Chokwe supported you know, democracy in Guyana. He supported democracy, and he was very much opposed to imperialism, whether it was in Iran and Palestine, South Africa, anywhere around the world. He was definitely in solidarity with the Cuban Revolution and supported the Cuban Revolution and respected it. So he was very much an internationalist, and he saw that our struggle of our people here was a struggle connected with struggle of people around the world against capitalism and imperialism,
okay,
wherever it might be. He was also a Pan-Africanist. He supported liberation movements in Africa and thought we should be also, we should work and saw our movement in context of, you know, African liberation movements around the world.
You know, in our last moment here, Akinyele Umoja talking about our friend and comrade, Akinyele's friend and comrade, Brother Chokwe Lumumba, who made his transition February 25th, Ashe. Say something.
Any last comments on my behalf?
I want you to asking you. This is your friend, and so I want Akinyele to talk about not the things that Chokwe did, which is a long list, but Akinyele and Chokwe. Say, just take
well,
a
it,
moment.
Like I said, now you're gonna make me tear up. But as I said, I became Chokwe's friend in 1979. When we were part of the National Black Human Rights Coalition. And as we began to work in, you know, in the early 80s to try to form the, forming the New African People's Organization, and our families actually became close. One funny story is his wife Nubia was pregnant with his son Chokwe. And my wife Aminato was pregnant with my oldest daughter Tashia. And Nubia came to visit us in California, and we were walking down the street, and I'm walking with these two pregnant ladies, and people were looking at me. But we, you know, our families became very, very close, where I feel like I'm uncle to his children, and they see Chokwe as Uncle Chokwe. My children do. I don't know too many people as genuine as this brother. I saw him as acting as attorney for Mutulu Shakur, and I remember being in their apartment and him just falling asleep at night behind his desk trying to prepare to go to court the next day, which is one of the reasons he was such a gifted attorney, because he's willing to sacrifice and work hard and go hard for his people. His death is a tremendous loss to us. But at the same time, I think he leaves a tremendous legacy for us to build upon in terms of the love he showed for people, particularly for people who are professionals, because he was able to be a professional who demonstrated you could use your skills for the liberation of your people and for the service of your people, and not to use them in a way that exploits or manipulates your people.
Okay.
I think he's one of the best examples of that.
Okay.
I don't know anybody more genuine than Chokwe Lumumba.
Akinyele Umoja, thank you so much for taking time talking about your friend. And as you travel and you're with the family, please send love from all of us here on the West Coast who know him and loved him and who work with him. Take good care of yourself, and we look forward to the Jackson Kush plan.
All right, thank you, my brother. Keep up the good work there.
All right, peace.
And Africa today.
All right, peace.
We love you and continue that work.
Please, my brother.
Peace and power.
We continue listening to the voice of Brother Chokwe Lumumba. We listen to a segment where he is talking about the founding of the Republic of New Africa, and then a short segment where he's talking about his first case, the case of Assad Shakur, one of his early cases.
At the founding, but I actually didn't know about the founding until a year after, because, see, I was in Kalamazoo.
Okay.
I was in school in Kalamazoo. It was founded in 68, in the 29th through the 31st of March.
Okay.
A year later, it came to my attention in 69, around the same time of year, when I was finishing my senior year because of the attack on the New Bethel Church by the police in Detroit.
Okay.
Aretha Franklin's father's church. The RNA, what made it so, which made it stand out so magnificently for me is that they won. You hear about these attacks on the Black Panthers and various other people by police on the movement. And the thing is that we'd get killed or we'd get arrested and kept in jail for long periods of time. The RNA, the Provisional Government of the Republic of New Africa, withstood the attack, some 800 rounds shot into the New Bethel Church. And nobody was killed. I think a couple people did get wounded. They were able to defend themselves, and a couple of the aggressors were slain. Okay. And include, which is a whole other story that we only can get into if you want to ask a question about it. One of the cops that got shot was a guy that had went to high school with me and played football with me.
Okay. Go, keep talking.
Okay. But in any event, so that came to my attention, and it began to make sense because I knew how racist a lot of these guys were who had went to that Catholic school with me and played football and basketball. So he got killed, trying to kill Milton Henry, we believe, who is Imari's brother. And so, and a close friend of mine, of my family's, were arrested. They initially arrested 149 people. Everybody was in the church. Old people, young people, everything else. White folks was outraged that blacks had stood up and actually defended themselves. So they arrested everybody in the church, although it was very clear that most of the people, 90% of people in the church, had no weapons or couldn't have done anything. But they arrested them. A black judge, who was one of the few black judges in the system, contacted through a network which included C.L. Franklin, who was an old civil rights guy, who was Aretha Franklin's father, who Malcolm talks about in his speech, you know, when he speaks in Detroit, the message to the grassroots. But old C.L. Franklin had contacted a politician who had then contacted one of the few black judges on the bench in Detroit. George Crockett, Jr. He's the junior. And George Crockett let everybody go. He says, like, you show me what you got on them. They had nothing on 90% of them. He let everybody go except three people who they had to post bond for, and those three people later went to trial and were found not guilty. And he gave the three people a bond, you know. So that brought it to my attention, A, because it was such a sensational event, B, because it was people I knew, you know, the brother who was arrested, a friend of ours, the brother, and when the white guy who got killed was a person I knew. And then finally, it came to make a sense to me because my thinking in terms of the movement, in terms of black power, you know, had begun to develop in the direction of that we as a people needed land. We needed independent land. And I began to understand that was the message of the RNA. I was somewhere close to where Marcus Garvey was, you know, and I had just, you know, moved in that direction, you know, because of concrete work I was doing in Kalamazoo, in addition to some readings I was doing. And I was very active in the student movement at that time. Well, Shokwe entered the profession with the idea that that's what he would do.
Okay.
Because Shokwe understood that fighting for nationhood meant to, try to help, as a lawyer, to try to help structure whatever legal concepts that new nation would need. So that was one thing. And B, to help defend the workers and the strugglers and the soldiers in that movement. So I came in there with that intent. When I actually started getting down to it, I was a little shy at first, to be quite honest with you. I got in there and, you know, I had no problem with representing people. I had no problem with getting into the court, even though every confrontation brings about a little fear, but, you know, you get over that. But when they first, the first case, they answer your question probably directly, that they come to me with, certainly outside of Detroit, and maybe even including the cases in Detroit, was the Asada Shakur case back in 1977. Matula Shakur approached me and said, well, Asada's in jail, and she's got a case in Brooklyn. Her aunt is on the case, too. and we need you to come in and work with her on the case. And I said, well, Matula, I'm just a young brother. I mean, I've been in this thing. You're talking about Assata Shakur, you know. So I was a little afraid, even though that was my objective. But then I said, well, you know, so, but he talked me into it, and I talked to Assata. And once I talked to Assata, I was sold, you know. And so I participated in that case with Assata's aunt. And fortunately, as we billed for the case, we were able to get it together so tightly that they dismissed the case because they realized they were going to lose it. But she had already won, as you know, seven or eight cases, I think, in New York, which they had charged her with. So that was the actual transitional case on a national level. On a local level, it was, you know, they became more gradual as I got. I spent my first year of practice. I started practice in 76, in May of 76. I spent my first year of practice in the defender's office, right, in the city of Detroit. It's actually a private defender's office as opposed to a public defender's office. That's another story. But I spent my first year in there, and as soon as I got out of there, I started to do work on my own. And one of the main cases that are one of my first big political cases there, which came around the same time as the Assata Shakur stuff, really, was Haywood Brown. Haywood Brown was part of the Brown, Boyd, and Bethune trio who had challenged Stress in the city of Detroit. Stress was the cop operation which came up, like in many cities in the late 70s or in the late 70s, that was killing black people, you know, that was doing a lot of repressive things. They had challenged Stress and won two or three shootouts where they killed Stress officers and got away. They had also challenged the drug traffic. They were busting into drug houses, taking the drugs, throwing them down the drain, taking the money and the guns, and then going on to the next thing. And so there was a massive manhunt put on for Brown, Boyd, and Bethune. Brown was Boyd, John Percy Boyd was murdered by the police in Atlanta. Mark Bethune was killed by the police in Atlanta. And then Haywood Brown was arrested. He was arrested and beaten almost to death, but he survived in Michigan, right? And so I wound up subsequently defending him on some of the charges that came up against him and was successful. He was found not guilty in some of them. And then in one of them, it was in a predominantly white jurisdiction, and it got hung jury like three or four different times. And so they finally dismissed it. But Kenneth Cockrell also was involved in his defense, actually before I was. So he defended him on several of those cases.
What was it about Assata that convinced you to take the case? This is what, the early 1970s?
Yeah, this was this was a little later in the 70s because she had been convicted in the early 70s. This was about 77, 77.
What was it about the conversation with her that convinced you that this was the case you wanted to take?
Well, Assata was just, first of all, she wasn't afraid of me taking it, number one. You know, she wanted me to take it. I mean, she believed in me, you know. So that was part of it. And she made you believe in yourself more, I think. And she was so at ease, and so even though she was a political prisoner and obviously in a very uncomfortable situation, Assata was a person who still had tremendous spirit, who had a conviction, first of all, that she wouldn't be there for the rest of her life. She had been convicted already and sentenced to life on that New Jersey charge. And I asked her, you know, I was real concerned about her, and I considered political prisoners just to be very precious, you know, a precious part of our legacy, a delicate part of our legacy. But I found out that she was, you know, she was beautiful, she was strong, but she wasn't that delicate. I mean, you know, she wasn't that fragile, let's put it that way. And it made me feel a little more at home with the job, you know, that, yeah, I'm young, you know, I can make a few mistakes, but I can get it done, you know, and that was the spirit she had. And she wasn't like ostensibly trying to talk me into taking the case. I don't know that she knew that was necessary, but just in the conversation with her, you know, those kinds of principles got over to me, and that's what I decided to do. So she energized me around the case, and I was happy to take it. I felt purposeful about it. And in the meetings I've had with Assata since then, it's reinforced that kind of energy around Assata. Assata told me specifically when I was there, I said, Assata, you know, wow, what's happening with your case? How's the appeal going? I was talking about the conviction from New Jersey. And Assata told me, she said, well, Brother Shokwe, I don't know, but you know, I'm not going to be in here forever, you know. And that was a statement she made, and she was right. She's a prophet, you know. So that helped me want to contribute to what she was doing.
The voice of Brother Chokwe Lumumba Ashe made his transition February 25th, 2014.